Welcome to another Sad Songs podcast with the Sad Songs crew. We've got Russell.
Good evening.
We've got Kenneth.
Yep.
And we've got Joe.
Yes.
The song we're going to talk about tonight is Between the Bars by Elliott Smith. This was the fourth song on the album Either Or, and the proposer for the song tonight is going to be Russ. So take it away, Russ.
So, yeah, the song that I'm bringing this evening is Between the Bars by Elliott Smith. Elliott Smith's an American singer-songwriter. He was somewhat a darling of the indie rock scene of the 90s. He's a guy that released five albums during his lifetime and one posthumous album. By and large, wrote songs that were quite downhearted, quite morose, quite... I guess self-critical. This is an example, I would guess, of one of those songs, a typical song by Elliott Smith. So the themes that often come up in his songs are themes of depression, loss, things to do with his dependency on alcohol and drugs. And again, this specifically is about his dependency upon alcohol, I think, this song that I'm going to speak about. He died in 2003. By all appearances, it seems that he died by suicide, although the inquest has been left inconclusive. There were some theories going around that it could have been death by homicide, but given his the life he lived, you can assume that potentially it was a suicide that he died by. Reading back on his sort of biography, and it's something I didn't know up until today, but it kind of makes sense. In his childhood, he lived quite a troubled childhood, and there were sort of indications of potential sexual abuse, which crop up in a couple of his songs as well. The song I'm going to talk about, Steve said, it's from the album Either Or. And again, doing some research on that earlier on, it seems that that's a reference to Kierkegaard. I don't know whether that's something you might be able to talk about a little bit later on, Steve. I don't know. But anyway, the song itself, it kind of documents a love affair of sorts with alcohol. And it's spoken from the point of view of what seems to be the bottle. It kind of documents the alcohol bottle tempting him to drink, essentially, saying that it's going to make things better. And it's kind of alcohol within it seems to be the solution of all problems. And certainly in my experience of working with people that have alcohol problems, it's a common theme that alcohol is the solution as well as being the problem. And the thing that maintains the addiction is that it can be quite an effective solution. It is quite a powerful sort of emotional analgesic of sorts. It works very well, certainly in the short term, at blanking things out and making things seem better. Despite the detrimental effects it might have later on. Now, there's a couple of lines, I guess, that I wanted to pick out that probably are quite indicative of an Elliott Smith song, of his kind of level of self-loathing and I guess, a sense of regret that you get. And one of those lines is, people you've been before that you don't want around anymore. That kind of indicates to me that it comes from a troubled sort of background. And I guess this is another song that I've picked, which is kind of at the bottom of that U. There's very little sort of hope within it. And in fact, the song title in itself, the double meaning that's in there, between the bars, it kind of implies a sort of imprisonment within an addiction, but also being between drinking establishments, another sign towards the addiction. And I guess the other thing to sort of mention is that the mood state's very much conjured up by Elliot's voice, which is very fragile, very vulnerable. It kind of cracks in parts. It's recorded, I don't know about the kind of, you know, recording technology behind it, but it sounds like he's speaking very close to the microphone, and it gives it a very intimate feel, and I think that adds to the sense of sorrow that comes along with the song. There's a kind of tensed feel that it feels like a lost fight that is contending with, and you know, there's not much of a sign out of it. So yeah, I mean, I find this song very effective and very very typical of, I guess, the state of mind of someone that's in prison within an addiction. And I'll open it up to you guys now.
Kenneth, would you like to go first and tell us what you think about this one?
Well, I'll say from the start, I knew Elliot Smith's album some years ago, Either Or, and I loved it, but I didn't actually listen to the lyrics particularly deeply. I got to know it more musically. It was something that was quite often in the car or around the house. And I always find with him that as you go into the lyrics and sort of get deeper and deeper into the meanings of them, the sort of song seems to change shape for me. Many of his kind of chord progressions and I think the way he sings are actually really quite inviting. They're very pleasant to listen to, and whatever kind of mood you're in, you know, even if you're depressed or, you know, in a particular day, you know, they're still really good songs to listen to. And I think quite often the chord progressions he has are really quite sort of quirky, almost sort of jazzy in with some inflections. And I think they really kind of keep you on your toes. They're quite sort of, even though it's just him with a guitar most of the time, minimal backing, there's a sort of sense of real kind of musical energy, even when some of the lyrics might seem, you know, quite dowdy, I guess. I had never really thought too much about the lyrics until today of this song. And I'd always thought that because he's singing to somebody else, it was kind of him trying to console somebody else in some way. But of course, as Russell mentioned, it's him talking to the bottle in a sense, or the bottle talking to him. And that gives it this real kind of really sort of air of pathos, which I find, you know, quite upsetting, really. And another thing that I always find fascinating about this song is that it's so simplistic and, well, so seemingly simplistic. There are simply two verses and a small chorus each, and then it's over. It's basically just him with a guitar. But I think the slightly more profound thing is that the chorus, which ends, you know, halfway through the song and then ends again as the song ends, kind of ends on this very open-ended note. It doesn't go back to the kind of the main chord that you're expecting. It's like, you know, ending a sentence, not with a, you know, not on a full stop. You just kind of think, and it kind of implies that this cycle is just going to go on, as if we're just seeing a very, very small snapshot of, you know, a very, very tortured life. So, yeah, that's my thought.
Thanks, Ken. And Joe, what did you think about this one?
So, similar to Kenneth, this is Elliot Smith, someone that whenever I actually listen to, I wonder why I don't listen to more, because it really is completely up my street. It's sort of my sort of thing. And this is a song I was very familiar with, but actually I'd never really got into the lyrics of, which again is really odd, because I'm actually very much a lyrics person. And the weird thing is, it's this song has this absolutely lovely, like Kenneth touched me, it's got this lovely feel to it, like a lot of Elliot Smith songs have. They have this like really quite beautiful, like gentle melody. And it does sound sad, I think, but it sounds quite sort of laid back and beautiful at the same time, you know, rather than just an immediate sort of all brutal sadness. So one thing, today I've been looking at the lyrics a bit more, and there's certain things grab me. So I don't, in terms of, you know, I think we all have our ups and downs and our sort of, it's well known that I do like a drink. And like saying this verse, this sort of drink up, baby, stay up all night with the things you could do, you won't, but you might, the potential you'll be that you'll never see, the promises you'll only make. It's a sort of a feeling I think a lot of people can relate to, that idea of the false promises you make to yourself in the when you're sort of, if you like, feeding those dark recesses, or you're lost in that at the bottom of the U maybe. And like, I've got on my phone, I have a notepad, and it's it's a mixture of, it's absolutely cluttered with stuff, and it's a mixture of really, really atrocious lyrics I write while ferociously drunk, and sort of, and actually quite a lot of commands and lists to myself, like, you will do this, like, get up tomorrow and write that award-winning film that you've been prattling on about for decades, or like, you know, design that thing you keep, you know, prattling on about. And I sort of, I feel like it connects with me a lot. The vibe of this song, the idea of being, not being able to live up to that potential that you feel like you sort of have, but you're squandering, but you're, I mean, this podcast, by the way, is me fulfilling my ultimate potential. But yeah, it's that sort of, it really hits home with me, I think. People you've seen before that you don't want around anymore. I mean, this is the sort of vibe I think we'll get a lot across songs on this podcast, is that sort of disappointment in your former selves, but then he's obviously in a state where he's not really moving past it. He's possibly promising himself things past it, but you know, there's a sort of you feel there's an understanding that it's not going to move on.
Ken, you've got your hand up. What would you like to say?
Yeah, just to build on something that Joe said, build on something that I'd said about this kind of sort of quite inviting sort of world of simplicity in there. I think there's a kind of childlike quality to it as well, like it's a kind of slightly childhood world, partly because I think his singing is so high up. You know, I'm not necessarily saying that he's consciously trying to mimic a time before his testicles took a turn for the worse. But there is a sense in which it kind of, for me, always feels like he's kind of a frightened child. And I think that, I mean, I didn't realize he'd had a difficult childhood, as someone mentioned earlier on. I think it was Russell. But yeah, it also ties in with this people you've been before, kind of going back into the past, as if he's kind of somehow or other trying to deal with it by getting back into it somehow or other.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the kind of the childhood abuse or the you know, potential that childhood abuse, and nothing has been confirmed in terms of that, I don't think, but you know, that's something which may indicate, you know, the his way of living in later life, his way of feeling about the world himself. You know, it's quite classic of someone that has suffered trauma in their childhood to turn to addiction, to turn to various forms of self-harm or you know, unhelpful behaviours, let's say, in order to cope with the world and their emotions. It's something I'd sort of meant to bring up before. And, you know, if you kind of know that, then his songwriting gets put into context a little bit more. There's a bit more background as to why, you know, he was... for want of a better phrase, so miserable throughout a lot of his work. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention as well is picking up on the line that the Joe sort of mentioned, that the potential you'll be that you'll never see. And, yeah, I'm sure that's a feeling that everyone has. But I think that line probably kind of also describes Elliot in a sense, because, you know, clearly the guy had potential above and beyond what he actually delivered. And I think, you know, I was aware of him in his lifetime, but I think his fame and his notoriety has grown more since that, and people have started to appreciate him as a songwriter.
Well, I've got a couple of things that I'll chime in with on this one. The first one is, someone did say there's a certain sort of flatness to the singing in this song. And one of the things that I noted about this was I really find it hard to get a kind of purchase on this listening to it, because it is so flat. It's almost hard to get anything that sort of sticks out and grabs you and makes you sort of listen to it and concentrate on it. The other thing that I'd say about this one is that I marked an essay this year by a student who'd written an essay about Elliot Smith, and it was a module where we talked about Freud, Morning Melancholia, which we've talked about in some other podcasts. And the student looked at Elliot Smith's album, I think, In a Basement Under a Hill. Is that right, Russ?
Yeah, that's his posthumous one.
The posthumous one, yeah. And it brought up this this notion that, you know, he'd mentioned that he'd been abused. And for me, that's really sort of made these records quite hard to listen to. There's another person who I would put in the same boat, actually, which is Jeff Mangum from Neutral Milk Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of his records, I find it really, really hard to listen to now. One of the things that psychoanalysis tells us is that what someone tells you, which in psychoanalytic terms you'd call the manifest content, is often a way that they've disguised or hidden what they really want to say. And that's what we call the latent content. But this latent content, what they really want to say, that maps onto something else. It's kind of like an onion. And the thing underneath that is, I suppose you call it a complex or the symptoms of the person, right? And in Freudianism, this does go right back to childhood, and it can be these things. And it's actually really hard to listen to people singing these songs, which you think are sort of tracking back to these like really horrible things that have happened to them. And it may have happened, it may be imagined, you know, people can rework it over. But it definitely seems like there's some sort of site of trauma there which is being sung about. And just hearing that, I find really quite difficult. Did you have something to say, Joe?
I did. And then you started saying things that were sort of quite sensible, and I lost my bottle a bit. But I was going to say, well, actually, two things, actually. I might as well. One was when I was looking at for videos of this being played live today, because I thought it was quite nice to sort of see that. There's a few, but what struck me was there's absolutely tons of people in their bedrooms doing acoustic covers. And actually, there's something I find quite moving about that. Like some of the covers, some of them are absolutely awful. I mean, I watched an inordinate amount. But I think there's something quite brilliant about a song that it touches people enough that they feel, you know, when they're completely imperfect in their own delivery, that they can sort of sit and broadcast it to the world. I found quite, I don't know, weirdly moving. There was like one guy, quite an old chap, who it was kind of awful, but at the same time was kind of wonderful. But anyway, that's as an aside, that struck me. Another one I was going to tell a tale. Usually me or Russell come up with some tale about we've seen that person and sort of, you know, whatever. Neither of us obviously saw Elliot Smith, but the first I actually think I heard of Elliot Smith was when me and Russell saw Ben Folds many, many years ago, and he played a song. It was actually just after Elliot Smith died, I believe. Russell might correct me on this. He's got a song. It was, wasn't it, I think? And he's got a song about Elliot Smith. Is it called It's Too Late, maybe? And it's about him touring around America and listening to Elliot Smith. And it's got some, it's a really nice song. But I remember mishearing it, and I thought it was Helen Smith. And I was completely confused for some time after about who this was. So that's my embarrassing story. That's actually very good. Ben Folds has a very good song about Elliot Smith.
I see someone's got their hand up. It's Kelvin Smith. Oh, no, sorry, confused. Kenneth Smith. What do you think, Ken?
You've got my alter ego wrong. It's Kelvin Smooth or Kenneth Smith. you put me off from a track there. I forgot what I was going to say. Yeah, it was really just, maybe an ethical thing. I'm just wondering how far we can take this kind of the knowledge that we have of a musician's life when we're kind of judging their works. Come really from the classical tradition where for hundreds of years after Beethoven died, no one would talk about Beethoven's music without talking about how he went deaf. And, you know, if he wrote a jolly piece of music, you know, wasn't it a testament that even in the pit of despair, he could find it within himself to write this wonderfully joyous music? And if it's a sad piece, then, you know, oh, this is his despair. You know, you kind of read it in relation to his biography, which is always, to me, a bit sort of spurious in a lot of cases in that particular era. But I think more so nowadays, where particularly when it's people are, you know, existing in a state of depression or despair, the first thing they reach to is music. And in a way, it does seem as though you know, the sort of the facets of their life really do sort of spill into our interpretations of their music, perhaps much more nowadays than they ever did in the past. I mean, we haven't really addressed George Jones as a songwriter. I mean, Stephen's written songs, I've written songs, but they're pretty awful. But you know, Joe's got some degree of success. Like, you've got a Grammy, haven't you, Joe?
Yes.
On a more serious note, you know, I mean, how much of your, you know, when you're making music, you're writing songs to yourself, how much of your own life do you kind of consciously put in these things? Or do you mask it? How do you square your life with your art?
I think I sort of try to mask it, but it's unbearably obvious when it's about me, because it tends to sort of, yeah, it will chime with things that everyone has seen happen to me or they know I've done. So, yeah. I'm pretty bad at that. I try and pretend stuff's about other people, but it's very hard, I think, to write as a songwriter. I think it's pretty hard to outside of yourself.
I think it's quite nice to listen to a song which is a sort of isomorphic with a sorrow of your own. You know, it's in the same space, or even if it's something which is a kind of comfortable space to move into and listen to something sad about. But if a song can really capture a sort of emotional state and you know, to some way put you in a place, then I do think some of these songs are quite hard to listen to if it's in the knowledge that that is the place that it's sort of moving you towards.
I mean, I reflect a bit on this question every year, because I, like Stephen, I teach a module in music and philosophy, but my module is called post-Wagnerian music and philosophy. So it's people after Wagner, basically, just in the wake of Wagner. And frankly, some of that music, I mean, I really do have to try my best to squeeze in some kind of uplifting, joyous music, just you know, once or twice per term, because I think some of my natural selections of music are just so kind of desperate. You know, it's all about sex and death with a preference for death. And, you know, I think, you know, lately, just last few, 3 or 4 years, just thinking more about people's mental health states, you know, I found myself having to give trigger warnings quite often. I mean, I'm discussing, you know, songs which, you know, are kind of people yearning for death, clamoring for death, in a kind of romantic sort of way. But, you know, anyone who goes to my lectures I'm extremely kind of jolly, you know, lively. It's as if this music doesn't, it's as if it's kind of, it really does get me emotionally. But it's through a kind of empathy with characters that are being portrayed, rather than actually stimulating or resonating with, you know, necessary aspects of my own life. And I kind of wonder, you know, if I was writing, you know, songs of my own, I think I would probably write this kind of music. And if I could write the kind of things that Elliot Smith's done, I love it. But it's not, it wouldn't be exactly who I was, you know. I would feel as though I was like playing the part of someone who was, you know, kind of extremely depressed, when I'm not at all.
And would that be an example of you know, appreciating the morning, whilst, you know, not being in that state of what was the opposite of morning, Steve?
Melancholia.
So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, I'm thinking back, it's just off the top of my head, but I mean, you know, in the sort of some of the early songs by, say, like from the 19th century, so I'm thinking of Schubert. I mean, he wrote about 600 songs. In those days, the idea was that you would take a piece of poetry by a really well-known poet, Goethe or Heinrich Heine or somebody, and, you know, you were kind of judged as a composer on how well you brought out the emotions of that text. So, you know, he would write music that was extremely dark some occasions, and then the next one would be, you know, absolutely full of lyrical beauty. And, you know, no one would ever even dream of saying, you know, Schubert was terribly depressed that day because he wrote this depressing song, this extremely sad song, because, you know, that was what was expected, that you were supposed to empathize with other people. And that was how you showed your gift as a composer, was through empathy. And I suspect that nowadays, I think people are writing their own lyrics for a start, which they didn't used to do in those days. And I think that in itself has allowed people to put more of themselves into it. And I'm not quite sure where to draw the line between, you know, the song as an expression of a person's life and thoughts and emotions, or whether it is something a bit more abstract that they maybe are identifying with or empathizing with a reality that could be a fantasy, essentially.
I mean, some of the sources kind of probably a bit sort of cleaner in a sense. You know, Goethe if it was a 20th century version of that and someone was sort of putting the poetry of someone like Paul Celan to music, then, you know, it would be probably closer to Elliot Smith, I guess, and a bit more uncomfortable to listen to in a sense.
Yeah, I think, and you do get a lot of that in the 20th century sort of art song repertoire. Yeah, it can be extremely uncomfortable. I mean, you know, some of... We were talking last night about, or the other day, about, you know, sort of speaking when you're singing, speaking, that kind of balance between them. And I think the one of the most famous examples of that was Schoenberg from 1913. And he wrote this cycle of songs called Pierrot Lunaire, all about, like, you know, absolute madness, really quite horrible things. And, you know, then he has this kind of, it's called Sprechgesang, sort of speak singing, to a really strange effect. And it's very, very difficult to listen to. I wouldn't even say it's sad. It's like a kind of insight into really extreme expressionist madness. And, you know, it was written at the same time as Freud, when Freud was, you know, talking around Vienna about, you know, the unconscious and the depths of it and the monsters that are lurking in there. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Russ, I can see you've got your virtual hand up. I'll just say something quickly about Kierkegaard and Either Or, because I don't want it to be the last thing of the episode. So from what I remember about Either Or, and this is just me doing this one from memory, so it might be a bit wrong, there's a kind of double Either Or in the book. So the first Either Or is the Either Or of the aesthetic life, the aesthete, who is sort of has an Either Or where they have different pleasures that they move between and cultivate and rotate through. So you might have a glass of gin today and then a glass of whiskey tomorrow. You might watch a film now or a TV show. And all of these sort of pleasures that you rotate through are sort of fruitless in a sense. You know, they're not going anywhere. But there's this very careful game that you can set up in your life where you have quite a nice life, I suppose, where you go through them all and you balance, you know, your boredom through them. And this is kind of that quite sort of basic Either Or, which Kierkegaard argues against, is contrasted to this bigger Either Or, which is the Either Or of living this sort of easy life or living a more difficult life, which is the life when you sort of throw everything into faith. And the Either Or Kierkegaard's trying to get us into is an Either Or into this realm of the ethical. And to get into the realm of the ethical, you've got to sort of throw everything in with belief and make this this jump that he talks about. Do you want to go for it, Russ?
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on something that the Kenneth mentioned, actually, about a sense of empathy for the artist. And I thought it was curious that a couple of people in this podcast had said they'd heard the song before, they'd heard the album before without listening to the lyrics. So maybe not giving the artist a sense of empathy that that he clearly deserves and the status in within the songs. I thought it was interesting that, you know, to the casual listener, it could just be a nice song, in inverted commas. But you know, when you actually delve in, you know, that kind of sense of empathy you have for the protagonists of the songs is really quite profound.
That struck me, Ross. I was thinking while I was listening to it, you know, this is the kind of music I could imagine being on in the background in like the cereal cafe where the hipsters eat their cereal or something like this. And really the content will be darker if anyone stopped to listen to it. Ken, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, just quickly then, just to add to that. I think it's a difficult one to empathise in some ways because their music, I always feel, is making that kind of childlike world, which I guess it's almost as though it's not really inviting you to actually think about anything deeper than that, which I think for me is maybe this kind of bar of empathy. That said, some of the songs that we listened to the last few days, thinking of the Katie song, which we talked about the other day. One of the things I noticed I've noticed for a long time with that one, is that the singer kind of seems to pervert the lyrics in a way, or pervert your ability to understand the lyrics first time. It's a bit like the Manic Street Preachers when, you know, they emphasize strange syllables, lines run into each other. And you really can't quite understand what is actually being sung a lot of the time unless you have the lyrics there. And it seems to me like some of those singers are kind of putting up this kind of barrier as if they don't want you to quite understand exactly what they're saying unless you're really serious and go and actually look for the lyrics and read them. That's not quite the same with Elliot Smith. I think the barrier there to empathy is the kind of, I don't know, I think the beautiful surface of it which, you know, I'm quite happy with the surface of these songs in a way. Going deeper, actually, in some ways seems to sort of tarnish that surface for some, you know, in some ways. But other songs like, I think perhaps the songs that are perhaps a bit more morbid or morbid musically, perhaps you're wanting to get more from the lyrics, wanting to find more from them, I guess. That may be an answer. I don't know.
One thing I thought that no one touched on that does actually strike me about this song is it's incredibly brief. And yeah. I think that plays into this whole idea of lost potential. It's like it's such a lovely song to listen to. You feel like it could go on for much longer. And you also feel like it should. It feels like it just stops. And that really struck me watching some of his live performances of it. It's like there's one where he meanders around for ages, sort of half talking to the crowd and taking suggestions for songs, but batting them all away. And then he begins, and it seems like nearly as soon as it's began, it's over. And that's just something that struck me about it, is it's only like, it's under 2.5 minutes long. And I think that's quite, I'm surprised no one mentioned it, because actually that really strikes me. It's such a lovely song, and it's got such a sort of power to it, but it's so brief.
Yeah, just to add to that, the song ends on this beautiful kind of minor chord, and it's, if anyone's a geek, it's minor chord 4, which should usually be a major one, so it's like a borrowed from the minor key, but it's always one that kind of implies it's got to move back to the kind of home chord and doesn't, so it's like the song really is supposed to kind of conceptually just keep going round and round as if there's more verses that are unsung.
Well, thank you all for another superb podcast. We'll be talking about Billy Joel's The Downeaster Alexa in the next podcast. Thank you for listening.